This is Florida Matters. I am Steve Newborn. It's been 10 years since the BP oil spill happened off the Louisiana coast when the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig exploded. Over the next 6 months, more than 200 million gallons of crude spilled into the Gulf. It's considered to be the largest U.S. oil spill ever. Now, there's no more tar balls washing up on beaches from Texas to the Florida Panhandle, but what about the lingering environmental effects of the disaster? To talk about that from our respective living rooms, we're here with Steve Murawski. He's the Downtown Partnership Peter Betzer Endowed Chair in Biological Oceanography at the University of South Florida St. Petersburg's College of Marine Science. Hey, Steve.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. Well, it's kind of hard to believe it's been 10 years already, but this has really consumed much of your life in the past decade, hasn't it?
It really has. We've been quite fortunate to have been funded at a very high level to do a decadal monitoring program of deep water, which is very unprecedented in the history of oil spill science.
So you've been out on the RV Weatherbird more times than you can probably remember. How many trips have you had? Where have you gone?
Well, we've done well over a dozen major expeditions, and our expeditions have taken us completely around the Gulf. So we did, obviously, you know, from Texas to Florida in the U.S. side, but we've also done two expeditions to Mexico, which basically took us from Yucatan all the way up to Tamaulipas, and then also we did an expedition to Cuba.
Did any of the oil reach that far? I know the currents, the ocean loop goes that far. Was any oil found that far?
We didn't find Deepwater Horizon oil down there or on the Yucatan. At least we don't think we did. But what we did find is that there's traces of oil everywhere in the Gulf. And that results not only from our oil industry and, you know, small leaks and discharges and whatnot, and then, of course, large spills, but also in Mexico.
Tell me about some of the initial findings at first. I know the effects on everything from sport fishing to dolphins was quite intense. Could you go into some of the effects that scientists such as you have found?
Early on, of course, you know, there was a pretty big scramble to try to figure out, you know, what a robust sampling program would be for a spill that basically transgressed to about 150,000 square kilometers at the surface and even farther at water depth. And so there were a lot of different studies that were launched back then, and it ranged from a whole variety of studies of the physical oceanography, the impact on biota, and then also very early on, there were a number of response countermeasures that were used. Things like the use of oil dispersing chemicals, flooding the Mississippi marshes with fresh water to try to keep the oil at bay, creation of sand berms around the Louisiana coastline, all kinds of things that were done back then. And both the combination of the oil spill and the countermeasures is kind of what we've been studying ever since. The real interesting parts of this are there are some obvious impacts that people have seen, particularly on birds and marine mammals. They get a double whammy, of course, in terms of not only ingestion of oil, but they also breathe the oil that basically is aspirated into the air. And so that becomes a problem for them. And of course, they're easily observed and quite iconic. Marine mammal population in the northern Gulf, particularly bottlenose dolphins around Barataria, is in a very poor condition even a decade later. Our particular expertise has been devoted to the fish. And so we've monitored basically 10 years of fish pollution. Early on, we saw evidence of skin lesions on things like red snapper, which the fishermen were reporting. So there was a lot of skepticism of whether or not that was basically a symptom of Deepwater Horizon pollution. And so what we've been able to track is, number one, that there was a dramatic decline in the frequency of that over the few years after, which points you into some kind of episode as opposed to a chronic solution. And it also correlated with the decline in the level of oil in those animals as well, which also tells you something's going on. But the key to that actually was a set of experiments that was done up at Mississippi, where they were able to actually induce these skin lesions by a combination of exposure to oil and high bacteria levels. And so that really gave us a mechanism for why this works. And some of my students have followed up and looked at the immunosuppression that happens with exposed fishes. And so a combination of the suppression of the immune system and the challenges of things like bacteria resulted in those skin lesions. So we were actually able to close the loop on one of these big conundrums that, and you probably remember that occurring back 10 years ago.
What I've been reading, you all researchers in general, and especially your group over at USF's College of Marine Science, sampled over 15,000 fish and you did 2,500 sediment cores. Let's talk about those cores and the historical data that you're seeing from this spill compared to what you've seen in the past.
So the sediment cores are really interesting because if you're in an area where the sediment isn't constantly being overridden by storms or whatever, then the sediment core becomes chronological. It records every year, you know, the amount of sediment that's deposited from rivers and whatnot. And so you basically have these layers, much like ice cores in the Antarctic, right? And so the idea there is you can take a core and you can use some isotope dating techniques to actually figure out how old an individual strata is. And so during the deep water, we developed some new methods using decay of radioactive thorium, which has a 22-day half-life. So you can actually date very carefully, you know, what went on. And then we're also able to look at things like oil deposition and other processes that were ongoing. So that really gives us a cool record of what went on. And one of the important things that happened during the spill was that oil came up in the water column, and then it attached to a normal process called marine snow, where it's like the dead bodies of plankton. And then it was ballasted down with fine clays coming out of the Mississippi River and deposited back on the seafloor. And that kind of violates everything you learned in high school physics, that the oil is supposed to float, right? Based on the studies of sediment cores, we have determined that somewhere between 4% and 10% of all the oil volume that came out of deep water ended up on the sea bottom because of this process of oil marine snow. And so the point there is it's not only on the bottom, but it's also having impacts on the animals that live either in the sediments or on top of the sediments, which actually includes some of the fishes. Over time, we've been able to track that as well.
So a recent study that you co-wrote said that you all did repeated sampling through 2018, 7 or 8 years after the Deepwater Horizon explosion, and you had written that no fish yet sampled anywhere in the Gulf have been free of hydrocarbons, a telling sign of chronic and ongoing pollution in the Gulf. Wow, that's pretty heavy. What kind of impacts does that have for the greater ecosystem here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Originally, what we thought we would do is explore around the Gulf of Mexico a little bit and see if we could find what we would call a control, an area that was unexposed to hydrocarbons. And that was one of the reasons why we went to Mexico and Yucatan, which has no oil industry, and down in Cuba, which, you know, they have no internal oil industry to speak of, and certainly not a marine industry. Everywhere we look, you know, we would find an oil fish at low levels, but nevertheless. So what it says to us is that oil pollution is quite frequent in the Gulf of Mexico. And it derives not only from oil wells, but it also derives from other sources, including natural seeps and other things, which makes it a little bit more difficult to disentangle the effects of a large oil spill as opposed to the natural processes that ongo. And so that's been part of our CSI, if you will, of trying to understand Deepwater Horizon effects.
The CSI forensic research was kind of affected by the lack of baseline data. You really didn't have any to see what was out there in the Gulf as far as the underwater fauna beforehand. Isn't that part of your mission right now to get a baseline so if, you know, heaven forbid, something like this happens again, that you'll know the effects of the damage a little more clearly?
Well, if you look at the hundreds of papers that have been published since Deepwater, you know, concerned with ecological things, almost invariably they mention the lack of pre-spill baseline. And certainly, you know, in terms of our studies on hydrocarbons in the animals, that was actually the first thing we looked for was, all right, well, what's the level of pollution in these animals the day before the oil spill? And the answer came up, we don't know. No comprehensive baseline at all. Which, when you think about it, you know, you've got an oil business last year generated 700 million barrels of oil and no baseline, you know, in terms of what the impact of that industry is on the fish, on the sediments, in the water column, et cetera. You know, so it's actually quite shocking to us that those baselines wouldn't be required as a cost of doing business. And when you think about it, every wastewater treatment plant in the United States has a requirement to generate ongoing monitoring information about the receiving waters that they discharge in. So I live in St. Pete Beach. There's a wastewater treatment plant up the road. That plant is required by EPA to submit timely reports about what's going on in the system.
Tell me about what you've seen out there. Any surprises out there? What really have you all come up with?
No end of surprising things that we've been able to come up with. Originally, you know, we thought that, you know, the animals close to the sea bottom would be the most heavily polluted, and they were to a certain extent. But we also saw things like yellowfin tuna that had high levels of oil pollution in them. And we are still trying to figure out why an animal that swims around in the water column where there's very little oil, even like 2018, would have very high levels of oil pollution. And we're still trying to work on what the sources and the physiology of these animals might actually be. So that certainly was a surprise to us. One of the big surprises is some of these countermeasures that were tried seem to be actually more problematic than the oil spill itself. So, for example, in the Louisiana marshes, we saw huge amounts of fresh water that were directed down there, and they had enormous impacts on animals like oysters, you know, for example, where they can't avoid the low salinity water. There's a critical level of salinity they require. Billions of oysters are killed because of that event. And actually, you know, that particular episode is going to tell us a lot about where a lot of the fine money is being spent in terms of its environmental impact. So there's an enormous amount of money from the fines, billions of dollars, that are going into replumbing the Louisiana marshes to try to open up diversions to the Mississippi to divert sediment and sand out onto the marsh to kind of stabilize it from sea level rise. And so one of the things we know is that it's going to flood those marshes with more fresh water. So the episode of Deepwater Horizon is actually telling us something that will play out over the next few decades in terms of how these animals will react to this. And certainly oysters is an animal of concern, as are the dolphins.
The fines you were just talking about was the BP fines and the billions of dollars. A lot of it was used for mitigation projects and such. So it actually looks like there might have been some good that came out of this, if you can, you know, have an optimistic viewpoint of that right there.
Obviously, what's happening is there's been a lot of environmental projects that the states have not been able to fund, and this large tranche of money, which amounted to $20 billion in fines and penalties, most of it coming back to the state's so-called trustees. They're funding a lot of projects around the Gulf, a lot of local projects that relate to stormwater runoff and enhancing environmental protections, land acquisition for parks and things like that. Even in the Tampa Bay region, a certain amount of money has been spent here for that. It's too bad that we have to wait for an environmental catastrophe to actually fund these things, which, you know, we should be doing anyway. You know, the big environmental benefit of replumbing those marshes is trying to stave off this inexorable land subsidence and creeping sea levels in those areas, which are already nearly underwater. I'm not sure how long those projects will last because they're not going to do anything about the proximal cause of sea level rise. You know, it just means we have to pull up our pants a little higher, right? You know, and so I think that's a short-term solution to a long-term problem.
Right, you may have to pull up your pants a lot higher. I'm sure there are several places you visited on the Weatherbird that are probably underwater now. I know a lot of islands off the coast of Louisiana that were affected by this, they don't exist anymore.
Well, that's correct. There's a chain of islands that sort of guard New Orleans called the Chandelier Islands, and they have virtually gone away over this time. And there was an island building program, which was a priority of the then governor of Louisiana, where a lot of sand was dumped there. And the Corps of Engineers did a post-evaluation, basically said it's all gone. Even the hundreds of millions of dollars that were spent in island building, that was just a temporary fix.
This is Florida Matters. This week marks the 10th anniversary of the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. After the break, we'll discuss the long-term impact on Gulf wildlife and the controversial use of dispersants. Stay tuned.
We're talking with Steve Murawski, a biology professor at the University of South Florida's College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg, about the 10th anniversary of the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill and its lasting effects. We'll get to dispersants in a minute, but first I want to talk about some of the ecological impacts to the fish and wildlife there. I remember reading after this happened, some of the endangered Kemp's Ridley turtles, for instance, were stranding at five times their rate. And, you know, of course, dolphins, people think of that as one of the keystone species. They're cute and they get a lot of attention that a lot of the other animals don't. They were washing up on shorelines at 10 times the normal number. What are we seeing today, 10 years after, as far as ongoing effects to the natural fish and mammal life in the Gulf?
There are what I would call residual effects, and that is injuries to the population that are still working their way through. And then there are ongoing effects. There are two reservoirs of the Deepwater Horizon oil still in the environment. One is in the deep sea. You know, as I explained before with the oil marine snow, that oil is there. It keeps getting resuspended, so it's still a problem for marine life at the bottom of the ocean, which include things like deep corals and animals that live on and in the bottom. And then the other reservoir is up in the Louisiana marshes in particular, where you can find that oil. And surprisingly, once the oil gets down into the marsh sediment a little bit, it's down below the level where oxygen penetrates. And some of that oil is almost unweathered in terms of being recognizable in Deepwater Horizon oil. So that will affect marsh animals up there for a long time to come. The other ecosystem that we're really interested in is in the deep water, there's a whole community of fishes called the mesopelagic fish. And these are small things that are about maybe maximum size, the size of your hand. They are very interesting because they migrate from the deep sea, maybe up to 1,000 meters during the day, and they migrate to the sea surface every night to feed on the plankton-rich waters in the top of the ocean, right? So based on the surveys that were initiated in 2010, it looks like there's a 50 to 75% drop in that community. So these are things we don't see very often. Those animals actually support as a food things like tuna fish and swordfish and other things, right? So even though they're not a community that people interact with directly, they potentially have long-term impacts on this pelagic ecosystem as well. And we don't understand why that it would take even more than 10 years. It could be that it's just a very unproductive place. It could be that there's an ongoing interconnection with the oil on the bottom. And it could be that by just taking such a big whack, that community just can't come back. So certainly that's the problem as well.
Is that having an effect on fish like sport fish or fish that people eat? Are we still seeing maybe lesions or oil in their livers, that sort of thing?
We can still find oil in them. And the real question is it deep water oil or some other source? And with the lower levels now, that becomes more problematic to try to find the source. What I would say is that originally there was a steep decline in most species in the amount of oil in them. And then it popped back up in 2017 when we did our last comprehensive survey. And we think what's happening is the oil on the sea bottom is not being necessarily landfilled there, but it's resuspended by passage of storms and underwater phenomenon that is sort of like shaking up a snow globe, you know, that the oil on the bottom keeps getting resuspended and then basically entering the food chain.
So every time a hurricane comes zooming up the Gulf, we're going to have tar balls maybe or some kind of effect on the ecosystem every time.
Yeah, we certainly will have tar balls for decades. And you see that when you see a hurricane in Grand Isle, Louisiana, for example. We know that there's a lot of oil there at the toe of the beach, you know, just underneath. And eventually that will get landfilled as well, but still we'll find deep water tar balls for a long period of time.
All right, Steve, one of the reasons why we're seeing a lot of oil on the bottom of the Gulf was the use of dispersants. This is a product with the interesting name of Corexit was injected at the wellhead site, and it mixed with the oil droplets, either causing them to float in the water column or sink right down to the seabed floor like you were seeing. A lot of studies say that this dispersant could contain cancer-causing agents, toxins, endocrine-disrupting chemicals that mess with the fish's reproductive capabilities. Let's talk about that. What do you see differently from this spill from previous spills because of the use of dispersants?
This is probably one of the most controversial issues stemming from deep water, and one that continues in terms of debate in the scientific community and in the management community. Deep water wasn't the first time oil dispersing chemicals are used. They actually go back to the Torrey Canyon tanker breakup back in the 70s where they tried to use detergents. This was an oil spill right on the Rocky Coast. They used things like paintbrush thinner to try to break up the chemicals, which are enormously toxic chemicals, right? So there was a whole push to get basically surfactants, which are, you know, the things in soap, to basically make the large oil globules into small droplets, which would be easier for bacteria to ingest and basically neutralize. So several generations of oil dispersing chemicals later from Torrey Canyon, Corexit is one brand of probably a dozen major, you know, brands that are used. They all have about the same toxicity to wildlife tested in the laboratory. So the real question that we have about dispersants is, you have the toxicity of oil and you have the toxicity of dispersants, and they're not highly toxic at this point, the dispersants themselves, as long as they're diluted out. The real question is, are they a binary weapon? When you combine the dispersant with the oil, does it create any more toxicity than you would have with the two individually? And so that's been a major course of study. And in fact, the National Academy just released a report about this. They actually looked at all the studies. Their conclusion was that moderate levels of concentration of the dispersant and the oil, that they were no more toxic than the oil itself. But at high levels, and at very high levels, then you started to get a toxic effect of the chemicals, right? So mostly when we look at measurement of the toxicity of dispersants and the concentrations in the field, they're at low to moderate levels, which is helpful. The real question in the novel use of dispersants in deep water wasn't that it was distributed by aircraft at the surface. That's been done before. But actually injecting the dispersant right in at the wellhead where you saw that 21-inch pipe sort of gushing out, they came up with a wand and they put it right in there. And the idea there was twofold. Number one, they figured it's got to be a lot more efficient to get the dispersant into the oil when you have a controlled field as opposed to trying to fly an airplane over a slick miles wide, right? And the second thing is there was concern about the worker health over the broken well when they were trying to drill a relief well to close the problem off, right? So that they were thinking that, you know, if you had dispersant down there, it would reduce the amount of volatile chemicals, you know, the toxic air that comes up when things start to evaporate. And so that's why it was done. The real interesting things that we have worked on in the last 10 years is whether or not that made any difference at all. One of the things that our group has done is create what we call Deep Water Horizon in a Can, which is basically a high pressure facility in Hamburg, Germany. And it's very clever engineers, basically able to inject the oil droplet with or without dispersants. But the key to all this was actually saturating the oil droplets with methane. That's the way the oil came out. And the good analogy is like a spray can or maybe a champagne bottle when you open it. That champagne is infused with carbon dioxide, right? When you have a big pressure drop, like when you open the champagne bottle, it spews out all over the place, right? We think that one of the major factors wasn't the use of dispersants, but that you created all these small droplets by opening the champagne bottle. And we know that there's a huge pressure drop when that oil came out of the hole and that basically went into the seawater. So the real question isn't so much how much we buried with the use of dispersants, whether or not it actually was helpful at all in those two primary objectives. And the scientific community is split on this. And what we need is either another field experiment where we can control this or a much larger experimental tank facility. I mean, the facility we're talking about is about 6 feet high, more at scale. And so I'm sure that the oil industry and the Coast Guard and others are going to think that that is the playbook for the next big subsurface blowout that happens. A lot of the scientists, including myself, are unconvinced that that actually is a method that actually does what it thinks it's doing.
Are there any new rules since this all happened on the use of dispersants? You know, this, you said the scientific community is split on this. I mean, if it happened again, would dispersants be used again in a similar fashion?
Well, the Coast Guard and the EPA and NOAA, they all say, look, every spill is different. We'll take a look at the circumstances. But if it's a deep water blowout, right, the bag of tricks is pretty small. And they include dispersants and burning at the surface and trying to corral it with booms and also what they call natural attenuation, which is basically let it go, right? One of the modeling studies we did indicated that where the oil industry is going out into the middle of the deep Gulf, you're not going to see a lot of that oil actually coming ashore. So the real question there is natural attenuation probably more of a let's do no harm, you know, as opposed to or less harm than perhaps even things like using dispersants.
One of the criticisms of using the dispersants at the time this happened was, all right, on the positive side, you didn't have oil slicks, not too many of them at least, going into marshlands and coating bird feathers. Well, you did see it a little bit in Louisiana, but you didn't see it outside of the immediate area of the spill. So there wasn't that public clamoring, you know, for people to do something, right? This happened in the middle of the Gulf on the ocean floor. Nobody sees it, right? So maybe the public relations angle kind of factors into the use of this too.
you know, people see the obvious signs washing up on the beach and whatnot. And they say, you know, the public says you got to do something about it. And, you know, part of that is picking up on the oil on the beach. There's no analogy to picking up oil in a salt marsh. I mean, you just can't do it. I mean, you do more damage tromping around on the salt marsh than letting it attenuate. And so I think there's always a balance of the perception as well, you know, what's an effective way to keep it out of the marsh, because once it's in there, it'll be there for decades, right?
So pretty much if this happens again, we're going to see the use of dispersants, probably the same thing happen, getting this dirty blizzard, as it's been called, suspended in the water column. Do you think we have better ways of dealing with it next time?
That's a good one. And a lot of people are asking that question at the 10-year anniversary of Deepwater, whether we're any better prepared than we used to be. From the industry's point of view, I know that one of the things that finally helped them cap the well was these so-called capping stacks, which are basically a blowout preventer on top of a blowout preventer. So if the accident happens the same way, the oil industry's put billions of dollars into development of new capping stacks as a measure to respond to a blowout. The real question is where in the cycle the blowout would happen. Because, you know, if it happens and it breaks out in the formation, for example, underneath the bottom and it's a diffuse spill, well, there's no capping stack that's going to take care of that. So that's a different scenario, right? The industry's certainly doing that. One of the things that hasn't happened, it's sort of like the dog that didn't bark here, is after the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989, the U.S. government put in place something called the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. And the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 way tightened the controls in how we actually respond to oil spills. After Deepwater Horizon, there's been no federal legislation related to oil spills. And that's in spite of the fact that in 1999, there was no ultra-deep drilling industry. This is a mile deep and deeper. Now the bulk of the oil derived from the Gulf is from the ultra-deep, but there have been no new regulations that have been passed. And after a decade, that's pretty surprising. I know this sounds like, you know, typical scientists, you know, more studies required, but there are a number of lingering problems that we need to understand. One of them is that the oil spill effects are not done, you know, within many of the species involved, and they require some monitoring over time. It doesn't have to be every year, but there should be some periodic monitoring to see just what the pace of recovery actually is. And then the second thing, I do think that there needs to be some sort of rule change or legislation to require more effective monitoring of what's going on, because that's going to allow us to respond better to the next oil spill.
Steve Murawski is a biologist at the University of South Florida's College of Marine Science in St. Petersburg. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
That's it for today's show. You can read more about the oil spill on our website at wusfnews.org. I'm Steve Newborn. Thanks for listening to Florida Matters.